give 30% of the investment to GRDC. We want 30% back on the ground in WA. I'd prefer to say, how can we drive the most value for Western Australian farmers rather than have it be on a pro rata basis?
Sue Middleton is one of two WA representatives on the new GRDC board. She's speaking there with Joe Prendergast. And as noted, she's also one of the two people on that board that are currently farming. There are eight people on that board in total. And I'm curious to hear from you on the text line 0448 922 604 whether you think there needs to be more farmer representation on that GRDC board. Duncan Young farms at Beverley and he's the WA Farmers Grains Section President. Duncan, do you think that that's a problem, that there are only two farmers on that board?
Yes, I think it is. And you've got to remember, one of those farmers is also the chair of the board, so he doesn't get a vote. So technically, you've only really got one farmer on the board. I agree with Sue. I think you need to have the right skill set on the board, but as an outsider looking in, certainly at the moment, the skew is well and truly on the research side of things as board members. So, yes, I'd probably question it. I think you probably need a good balance. You certainly don't want to have a stacking of board.
And why is that a problem in terms of the role of that board?
I think just a perspective of where, you know, relevant things to farming are. I mean, yeah, it's sort of, I think you need quite a diverse board. I think putting interest in one area doesn't necessarily go well for the future. I'm certainly reserving my judgment to see how the board goes over this next tenure.
Could the argument be made, Duncan, that it's the role of groups that report and consult to the board, like the Western panel, to you know, boost up that perspective from the farming side of things?
Yes, it is. But ultimately, it's the board that makes the decisions of where GRDC goes forward. Of course, they're going to take all the relevant information from different areas into account. But, yeah, it's ultimately up to the board to make that decision.
Have you had any farmers bring this up with you, concern about the makeup of that board?
There's certainly farmers out there that are probably very surprised by the announcement and probably like myself will wait and see whether it's going to be whether that's going to have any impact on direction or board decisions in the future.
Now, we should make it clear, as people would know, that this board is a ministerial appointment, so it does come from the Office of the Federal Government. So do you think that there should be another way that perhaps the board members are elected or appointed?
The GRDC is an RDC, so in its present state, it's up to the minister and solely the minister to appoint the board. He uses an advisory panel and then makes his decision, but it really is up to the minister. He can pick whoever he likes and take off whoever he likes. If you want to go down the line of appointing board members by a populist vote, then you'd have to go to an IOC, similar to, along the lines of MLA or AWI. So they've already transitioned from an RDC into an IOC. They're two different ones and a very different makeup. But, you know, if GRDC in the future goes down that line, then it's up to the growers to decide who sits on that board.
Now, I know it's difficult at this point, Duncan Young, because we're basically anticipating what we think the performance of a new board would be. But if I can just backtrack with you and ask, you know, how do you rate the GRDC's performance in recent years?
I would give it a fairly good rating. I don't know if I'd rate it on a number scale, but certainly, well above average. I'll wait and see how the new board goes.
And could the argument be made that the everyday farmer is often too busy to sit on a board like this?
Yes. And also, you know, there'll be certain farmers out there that, probably wouldn't want to get involved in something like this. But I think from what I understand, there were a large number of applicants, and a large number of those were farmers. I believe quite a lot of them had the skill set to do it. So, you know, ultimately it's the minister's decision.
And I'll just take you in a slightly different direction now. Duncan, it was mentioned there in Joe Prendergast's chat with Sue Middleton. Given the role of Western Australia and its significance in the export wheat market, do you think that there's enough work being done by the GRDC for the WA grains industry in comparison to what's done for the eastern states?
Short answer, yes, but it can always be more. You've also got to remember there's a lot of work that's done that is for a national interest, that doesn't matter what state you're in, that work's been done for the betterment of all grain growers across the country. So it's very hard to say, you know, we should be getting more money or you know, percentage-wise. I think really you've got to look at the bigger picture, because sometimes when they say we're only getting X back, they don't put into the equation that overall national work that's been done that benefits all growers. And when you put that in the equation, WA, I don't think, gets too bad a deal out of all of it. You know, I personally, I'd like to see more, but, you know, I'm going to put my WA farmer hat on, and, you know, of course we'd want to see more research done in our state, but we don't get a bad deal out of it overall.
Duncan Young, thank you so much for your time on the Country Hour. He's a Beverley farmer. He's also the president of the WA Farmers Grains Section, representative of WA Farmers there. And we have received a couple of text messages in on this on 0448 922 604. One in from Steve, who says, farmer numbers on the GRDC board is irrelevant. Best skill set and good regional panels are more important. Thanks for your thoughts there, Steve. It is just coming up to 20 minutes past 12, and I do have a couple of other text messages questioning in particular Sue Middleton's skills and expertise and whether she is suitable to that board. We are, of course, talking overall about farmer representation on that GRDC board. You can send me a text on 0448 922 604. Let's move across now to an interesting bit of news out of the resources sector. And you might be surprised to hear that a union isn't jumping up and down about imminent job losses when it comes to automation. I mentioned yesterday that Rio Tinto has just completed what it says is Australia's first fully autonomous heavy haul train journey. It was in WA's Pilbara region, about 100 kilometres from Wombat Junction to Paraburdoo. And this move towards automation means that next year, up to 60 Rio Tinto train drivers are going to be made redundant. But Gary Wood isn't too concerned, and he's the WA secretary of the CFMEU's mining division. He says he saw this coming.
Obviously, it's going the first step in what we call significant change, which does have a big impact on drivers. The loco drivers, they're born to drive locos, but going forward, the reality is that there will obviously be less we'd see mainline driving to and from the inland to the coast. However, we're fortunate enough to have in place an agreement which provides for how the transition is going to occur. One of the key factors of that is obviously full consultation with all parties and keep informed and what have you, which thus far Rio Tinto have been. There's been a few areas where we've had to have discussions, but generally the industrial agreement provides for, in the first instance, voluntary redundancies going forward. So, and there won't be any of those until the end of June 2018. And at that time, there's actually around about 50 to 60 positions would become redundant. So that's the first step in it, but there's processes in place how that would occur on a voluntary basis.
So up to 60 voluntary redundancies could be on the table by June 2018.
That's what's the information that's been provided to us is saying. But the role will change. There is still the significant role for where we have drivers with yard competency only, and they will be trained up to mainline competency. Because a lot of work is actually in the recovery zone, because the way it works is that one the automated train stops, they all stop. So it's about trying to get them moving again. So there will be a process of setting up recovery drivers throughout the line in various ways.
Over in the UK, Gary, Labor leader Jeremy Corbyn has been backing the idea of a robot tax to protect government revenue that you lose when human employees disappear. Do you think that's got merit?
Now, where are we going with technology? You know, at the end of the day, how are we going to finance different projects? Where are the labour? How is labour going to be involved in a lot of these things? So, I think the government needs to sit down and have a good look at where we're going to in this new age world, and where the income, where the jobs are going to be. We can say, they can be in automation, they can be this and that, but at the end of the day, we need to have real jobs which have real income. And are we going to be employment opportunities? Are they going to be left behind?
The possibility of automated trains has been on the cards and the drawing board for a little while now. But with this week's first fully automated trip, how are the human drivers feeling about this, Gary, and knowing that June 2018 is also fast approaching?
Oh, look, they realise there will be still an opportunity to drive locos, but locomotive drivers, they are there to drive trains. They love the position, but the position will change significantly, which is going to some drivers may choose to take a redundancy and move to another area, but those other areas like BHP or others, they're moving and they will continue to move to automation. We can sit back and oppose the introduction, but at the end of the day, it's inevitable. It will occur, and we've got to try and put in place best protections for drivers into the future and what we can do.
And these robotic trains, are they able to detect things on the track up ahead, be it the cow that suddenly springs across the road or the stupid vehicle that thinks it'll make a dash for it or rocks or anything underwood? Can it detect far enough in advance something on the line that a human eye might detect?
That's the area, and that's where, drivers will say, look, they can see the unpredictable or detect the unpredictable, and that's the concern that we have. But at the end of the day, the regulator for rail safety has approved the operation. To have an argument about that, we'd most probably be on a loser. You rely on the safety authorities to determine what's safe, and they've got to take into account the public interest.
Gary Wood is the WA Secretary of the CFMEU's Mining Division, speaking there with Vanessa Mills. But suggesting that this is just the reality of the situation, that automation will lead to job losses. And the ABC has requested an interview with Rio Tinto this week. However, no one has been made available. And we did share this story up on our WA Country Hour Facebook page yesterday. Lots of your comments streaming in up there on the Facebook page. One in here from Matthew that says, good to see it's going to be doing blue-collar workers out of work, and people in the city in an office will be driving these trains. Another one in here from Stephanie who says, stop replacing jobs with technology. And Sam questioning, will they really save that much by putting a few drivers off? You can get in touch with me today on the text line as well, 0448 922 604. And there are concerns today over job losses in the resource sector, but for a different reason. The Chamber of Minerals and Energy has taken its campaign against the government's proposed gold royalty increase to the steps of Parliament. The CME has suggested that if the government goes ahead With a 50% royalty increase, then 3,000 jobs will be lost. The Deputy CEO of the CME, Nicole Roche, was outside Parliament House this morning after meeting with the Treasurer. She told journalists that she and her colleagues explained to the Treasurer that five mines would be affected, which would lead to job losses.
When you look at when additional costs are imposed on a business, those costs have to come from somewhere. Payroll is a first area where companies look. They also look towards exploration, which is a discretionary spend. Both of those have an impact immediately, but also have a long-term impact in terms of the viability of the sector. We certainly had a very good conversation with the Treasurer, seeking to explain to him our case and seeking to explore what options there might be to be able to go forward with this conversation. We'd certainly like to see them remove the proposed increase in the royalties.
And for his part, the Treasurer, Ben Wyatt, says he felt he had a very productive meeting with the CME. He says he's willing to keep talking to the gold resources sector, but he hasn't changed his mind about the royalty increase.
I'm keen to hear from them around, for example, the transition price currently at $1,200 an ounce, around perhaps the issue of the 2,500-ounce exemption threshold. I'm keen to engage on the implementation of this policy. The policy is now law, it's been gazetted, but I'm keen to engage around any implementation that the CME can reliably actually give me data around that so that we don't have any unintended consequences. That's what I'm keen to hear from the CME. And what I have been particularly disappointed about is that there has only been rhetoric, and to be frank, quite inflamed rhetoric from the gold sector. I think we need a better provision of information if they actually want to be taken seriously. Because as I said, the market reaction, the analysis of those independent banks, etc., that engage in this space on every single day are fairly ambivalent about this royalty increase.
That's the WA Treasurer, Ben Wyatt, outside Parliament this morning. But it can't all be doom and gloom for WA's gold mining sector. Today's West Australian reports that Canada's Kirkland Lake Gold has just invested $5 million in WA company De Grey Mining. And De Grey share price jumped 50% to a record high. Another company that wants to mine gold in WA's Pilbara region, Chalice Gold Mines, has just announced it will assess new exploration licences covering almost 900 square kilometres. As a result, its share price increased about 34%. And shares in Kin Mining rose as well after a feasibility report showed its Leonora Gold project could be a high-margin mine. So important to keep those stories in context. It's 12:30. Rebecca Dollery joins me in the studio for news headlines.
Thanks, Bridget. Las Vegas police have updated the number of firearms belonging to Stephen Paddock, who killed at least 59 people and injured more than 500 at a music festival yesterday. After raids at the 64-year-old's home and his Las Vegas hotel room, police have recovered 42 guns, as well as explosives and thousands of rounds of ammunition. The Reserve Bank has kept official interest rates unchanged at the historic low of 1.5% at its monthly board meeting. The decision was widely expected. Market analysts are tipping two interest rate rises over the course of next year. And the Reserve Bank Governor, Philip Lowe, has repeatedly said the next interest rate movement is likely to be an increase. And WA Supreme Court has heard an autistic teenager whose body was found in a Perth backyard in June last year was dropped at a shopping centre after receiving a call from a woman. 26-year-old Gemma Lilly and 43-year-old Trudy Lenner are on trial, accused of stabbing 18-year-old Aaron Padgett, whose body was found buried under a slab of concrete in Ms. Lilly's backyard. Thanks, Bridget. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Beck. Rebecca Dollery there with the news headlines. Time to cross now to the Weather Bureau. Mark Paul is there on deck for us today. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good day, Bridget. How's it going?
Pretty good, thanks. What can we expect across our Southwest Land Division over coming days, Mark?
Yeah, well, today we've got a basically a ridge of high pressure and a very weak cold front moving in through the Eucla. We're basically expecting to see some showers about southern coastal districts and adjacent inland areas. They'll contract back to the south coast by this evening and then persist there in the onshore flow on Wednesday. Only very light falls expected along those southern coastal districts with that onshore flow. A little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity is possible in the far northeastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. That would only be the central wheat belt area during tomorrow, and that's associated with mid-level trough that's developing through the central parts of the state. Could see some moderate falls as that goes in through the goldfields and southern interior, but the parts that are going to hit the northeastern parts of the central wheat belt will be fairly light. On Thursday, still a little bit of shower activity about southern coastal districts in the onshore flow. That should clear off in the afternoon. The remainder of the Southwest Land Division should be fine. Then on Friday, another very weak cold front approaches the Southwest Capes Friday evening. So expecting some showers to develop about the Southwest District and adjacent parts of the South Coastal District, sort of towards late afternoon, early evening. Falls, once again, still fairly light associated with that frontal feature. That front will then push through to lie near Perth to Bremer Bay by 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. A little bit of shower activity persisting through that, but should contract back to the Southwest District during the afternoon before increasing and extending again to more or less anywhere southwest of the line from Perth to Bremer Bay by evening as a second feature moves through. Once again, anything in the Southwest Land Division is going to be very light, with predominantly most of the rainfall figures recorded, I suspect, will be best about the coastal parts. And that's pretty much it for the Southwest Land Division.
Anything to report for northern and eastern districts there, Mark?
Yeah, pretty active through the northern and central parts of the states, and that's associated with this mid-level trough that's moving through there. Expecting showers and thunderstorms literally everywhere through northern and central and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division on Wednesday and Thursday. Could see some moderate heavy falls, as we said, in the sort of northern gold fields and the southern parts of the interior on Thursday. That activity will persist through central and eastern parts of the state on Friday, and we could see some gusty storms developing in the northern interior Friday afternoon. Then on Saturday, once again, northern, central and eastern parts of the state are going to see shower and thunderstorm activity, and we could see some gusty storms on Saturday through central and southern parts of the interior. The only parts that are probably going to be fine for all that period would be the western Pilbara, the western Gascoyne, which will remain fine for those 4 days.
Any warnings?
We've got some strong wind warnings current, and they run from literally Carnarvon all the way around to the South Australia border, and that's associated with this new ridge of high pressure that's pushing through.
Thanks so much.
No worries.
Mark Paul there is a duty forecaster with the Weather Bureau, and Richard Hudson has just joined me in the studio to run through the rainfall in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. Oop. Except I haven't turned his microphone on. There he goes.
You've got to make sure you turn me on. Up in the Kimberley, Gibb River, 21 millimetres. Leopold Downs, 21. Marion Downs, 7. Mount Elizabeth, 29. And Siddons Creek, 6. They're all the ones that are over 5 mils. No rainfall recorded for the Pilbara, Gascoyne, Interior, Goldfields, Eucla, or out on the islands. And nothing in the central west or the lower west either. But in the southwest, a little bit around. Those over 5 are Northcliffe with 6 and Walpole with 9. And then in the southern coastal, a bit more. Albany 6, Shane Beach 8, Denbarker 7, Denmark 14, Gardner 9. King River and Narrakup West had 5, Metla 9, Nalyalup 5, Porongrup South had 11, Tamar 7, Warrajarra 6 and Windrush had 9 over 3 days. Nothing in the central wheat belt, and then in the Great Southern, Cranbrook had 5.
Thanks so much, Richard Hudson there, taking us through that little bit of rainfall. And on the text line, from Facebook, I've got another comment here just off the back of that story that Rio Tinto will be making up to 60 train drivers redundant as it moves towards autonomous trains that drive themselves. Tim says, what happens when it stuffs up like their haul packs have? A runaway train would be awesome, says Tim. Thanks for your thoughts there. You can also send me a text on 0448 922 604. It's 24 minutes to 1 o'clock.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
You're with me, Bridget Fitzgerald. It's great to have your company this afternoon. And as we heard there in the weather, it is overcast and threatening to rain a bit in Esperance today. And that weather is the only thing that's holding up the official start of harvest for 2017-18. The CBH Group is expecting its first delivery of canola at the Esperance Port very soon. If the weather clears, it may happen today. If not, it's going to start in coming days. Joe Prendergast spoke with CBH Esperance Zone Manager Mick Dore, who's preparing to receive one of the biggest crops he's ever grown in the region.
Yeah, we expect it to come in today or tomorrow. So there was a bit of early sown canola that was swathed a few weeks ago. And, yeah, hopefully if the weather stays good, we should see it coming in the system, yeah, today.
What do you know about it? How's it looking?
Looking good. The early samples we got were all pretty positive, good oil, and yeah, just waiting for the moisture to come back a bit, but otherwise it looks to be good.
Mick, how much grain are you expecting in the Esperance Port Zone this harvest?
So that's a really good question. we've got our bin meetings this week, and you know, we at the moment are planning for another record crop. Which is, you know, somewhere between 2.7 and 3 million tonne is where we're at the moment. So we'll get a lot better idea after the next couple of weeks' bin meetings.
And what's the breakdown of that 2.7 to 3? How much of that would be wheat?
Yeah, so a bit over 1.4 million tonne of that will be wheat. Canola this year, the hectares have increased, and that's probably one of the reasons why we're not quite as bullish in terms of the record. You know, we're up 100,000 hectares on canola, so that'll be, you know, somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 tonne of canola. And then probably 800,000 or 900,000 tonne of barley.
What does it mean for you from a logistical point of view, Mick, if you do get close to that record crop this year?
Yeah, again, everything's going to be under a lot of pressure. Sites are going to be full. We've, looked at some of the sites that we've had pressure at the past, and you know, grass patch, we've added some extra storage. The carryover position is a lot better this year than it has been the last couple of years, so that adds another 100,000 tonne of capacity, you know, predominantly in the port to help with that. But so we're sort of looking at all the options as to where we can store it, and you know, I guess our next challenge is harvest shipping, and at the moment that's not really looking too favourable, so we, you know, may have to reconsider some of our storage options as well.
Why isn't shipping happening, Mick?
I think it's probably one of the areas that, you know, a few different things are causing it to be delayed. Probably the smaller crop, I guess, anticipating how that's going to come off and where it's going to be. So I guess that's probably a marketing question. But yeah, we're used to having a reasonable amount the last few years, and this year it seems to have dropped off a bit at this stage. But you know, still hopeful that might pick up as well.
So how are you feeling? Are you sprouting a few more, or a few, grey hairs? I shouldn't assume that you have grey hair, Mick.
Yeah, there's already some there, and there's not a lot of it. So, it's great. You know, we're really fortunate to have the challenge here with a big crop, and, you know, I've got to say, it's a much better problem to have to try and find somewhere to put the grain than not having, you know, the crop around. So, you know, we're looking forward to the challenge, and we're as ready as what we can be, and hopefully we can, yeah, get it all in and undercover as quick as possible.
Mick Dore from the CBH Group in Esperance. Speaking there to Joe Prendergast. It's also guessing his hair colour a little bit there, Mick. Sorry to make those assumptions about you. So looking like we might be very, very close to the beginning of this coming harvest. Some internet users in rural areas around Australia might have thought Sunday was like Christmas in October. New data limits for those using the SkyMaster satellite network kicked in, doubling the data allowance to a maximum of 300 gigabytes a month and peak use to 75 gigabytes. Christy Sparrow represents a group called Better Internet for Rural, Regional and Remote Australia, or BIRRR, as it's known. She says, depending on your plan, the increase in data allowance comes at no extra cost.
It sort of felt a little bit like Christmas on Sunday when I logged in to check my account and saw all of this wonderful data sitting there. I didn't tell my kids that it was there. I think it's certainly a step in the right direction to improving the telecommunications issues that regional Australia has had.
Who will get that maximum amount of increased data?
So if you were on a high-end plan on one of the, like, 70 to 75 gigabytes of peak data previously, then you will be able to access that 300 gig, or you can upgrade your plan to access that.
And are all the providers giving service? Because I think there are 11 providers.
So far, we've had seen new plans from 9 out of the 11 providers. We're still waiting to hear from 2.
And Christy, how much are people paying for this increased data?
It used to be an average of around $80 to $100. And so I'm guessing that we haven't actually worked out the averages yet, but I'm guessing it would work out to be about that for 80 to 100 gigabytes of data.
So will people have to pay more if their data's increased?
No, so their plan stayed the same. However, the data increased. If you wanted to access a higher plan, then obviously you would need to pay more for that.
So, Christy, you said it was like Christmas Day on Sunday when you woke up and saw all this increased data. What's it mean for you in your life?
So it means that I can update things, whereas before we waited until we were going to free Wi-Fi, you know, at a motel or McDonald's to update our devices and our laptops and things. So definitely we were able to do all our phone updates. It certainly means that we won't have a fear of being shaped each month. Coming off a month of being shaped, having the kids home from boarding school, it was not a nice experience trying to conduct business whilst being shaped. The service is not usable at all.
What about speed? Download speeds and upload speeds?
Yeah, well, I'm quite happy with my SkyMaster download and upload speed. It's certainly a lot faster than what I was getting on mobile broadband. So I'm on a 25 down and 5 up speed, which is, from all reports, I'm getting quite better speeds than a lot of people in metro areas on ADSL.
You're getting lots and lots of comments on the BIRRR website. What are people saying?
So there's some mixed reactions. Obviously, this is just a step in the right direction, but for most people, this is going a long way towards meeting their needs. We're still keen to work with the government and work with NBN for those people that have higher-end data usage, such as tertiary students and big business. So while it is a step in the right direction, it certainly hasn't solved the data drought.
And so what is left to be solved?
There's still lots of issues, including customer service and reliability of service. It's not just about data limits. So when we, you know, advocate for regional areas, we're looking at services that meet people's needs, that are affordable and reliable, and also that have a customer service guarantee. If you ever try to contact your customer service office of your provider, it can be a very frustrating experience.
And are you getting any improvement in that area?
I think we're certainly being heard. I think we've still got quite a way to go in that area. But this new data will certainly be a game changer for a lot of people.
You said data limits, they've been increased, they've been doubled. What about reliability?
So the SkyMaster service has improved in reliability since last year. It was plagued with issues last year. Over the last few months, it has been quite stable. There has been a few weather-related incidences, but I think that NBN are getting much better at letting people know about those outages, and we're looking forward to having NBN website show where outages are in particular areas. They already have a hotline, which is great if you don't have any other internet service and you have an outage, you can ring that hotline and find out what's happening.
And what about affordability?
I think we're still paying a lot more than people in metro areas, but it's something that we're working on. And I think with these new data limits, we're getting closer to becoming more equitable.
You mentioned the weather. What about you're out at Alpha. What did you get any rain?
Yeah, we had 26 mil of fantastic rain. We were very excited when it started to rain. It actually didn't cause any problems with our SkyMaster service. However, heavy rain will take your SkyMaster service out. And if there's heavy rain at a ground station, or as we saw last month, there was snow in Tasmania, which took out quite a few beams on SkyMaster.
And that's just a fact of life? There's nothing you can do about that?
I think that there's still continual tweaking that can go on to fix those issues. The rain at ground stations now is much better than it was. Every time it rained in Kalgoorlie, my SkyMaster used to go out. That's not the case anymore. So I think with improvements, we're basically testing a live service, so it's bound to get better as we go on.
Christy Sparrow is one of the volunteers representing the group called Better Internet for Rural, Regional and Remote Australia. definitely clear with the message in their name. She was telling Robin Cockey how happy she is that data increase for NBN SkyMuster satellite has come through for internet customers. And as you heard, Christy now lives near Alpha in the Barkindine region in central west Queensland. A couple of your texts have come in on the topic of driverless iron ore trains. Greg in Newman says, Rio have driverless haul trucks at Yandi mine site, and I understand their trains run on auto with one person on board. Thanks for that information there, Greg. And Owen from Bruce Rock says, wasn't the iron ore royalty increase going to cost jobs? Better spend a few million to stop it. They can always recover it by sacking the train drivers, automating the system and claiming the hundreds of millions as capital works tax deduction. Owen wonders who is next on the list. And on Facebook, Wayne says, farmers are excited about driverless tractors and boom spray, etc., etc. What's the difference? And Michael, having a bit of a dig, says, my son has been doing this for a while now and he's three. Dropped the ball, Rio. You should have done this a decade ago. You can let me know what you think on 0448 922 604. It's 12 to 1. And the school holidays do continue this week, to those who aren't aware that you might have a house full of children. And for some, it can be a little bit boring for the kids who've got not as many activities to keep them occupied during the holidays. Well, that wasn't the case yesterday when Aboriginal Liaison Officer for the Geraldton Police, Bobby Pepper, took a busload of kids out of town to visit a farm where they were shearing some 300 sheep.
So what's your boy's name?
I'm Lex Mine, I'm 11 years old. My name is Jaden Aria, and I'll eat you in a kidney, make you end up in Sydney.
All right, so what's happening here?
We went through Northampton, came here, we checked out the shearing, the people shearing the sheep.
Yeah. Something that you guys want to do when you get older?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was it smelly?
A little.
Not too bad?
Yeah.
And what would you guys be normally doing on a school holiday like today? What would you guys be doing normally?
Go beach every day.
Go beach, yeah.
Go downtown,
yeah. Is this good getting out and about, getting out of town?
Yes.
So we don't have to sit around and do boring stuff.
Yeah. Gets a bit boring sometimes, eh?
Yeah.
And what do you like singing Mr. Pepper? You reckon he's alright?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the best.
He's the best?
Yeah.
Hey, Bobby, you got a lively bunch of kids there today.
Yeah, mate, I put on a bit of a spot. Actually, I got a busload of kids and I got a yard full of sheep. So, but all is good. Yeah, we control them after a while. But we made this happen for the kids, and it's good. And yeah, like I say, I want to thank Daniel for the farm and the patience for the shearers. Yeah, yeah. Putting up with sheep and kids together don't work, let me tell you.
Looking at the kids' faces, they look pretty happy and pretty amazed at the shearing team and what they're doing there. It's an eye-opener for them, isn't it, coming out to a place like this?
It is an eye-opener. It is an eye-opener. But a lot of the kids never seen this before, and they want to know how that wool gets square like that in that bale. I said, that big press, so yeah. But amazed, they didn't know this was here before, sort of like life on a farm. It's different, yeah. Yeah, the fly's frightened, but I'm glad something did.
Yeah, I'm Daniel Gill, the owner of the Sandhurst Paul Moreno stud. We're just finishing up the shearing, just been crutching all the breeding ewes, shearing lambs and, shearing the cull ewes and the old working rams.
The shearers in there have already got a bit of a hard work on, but they've got kids to look after as well. Tell us what's been happening with Bobby and the kids.
Yeah, Bobby's just brought up a busload of kids from Geraldton to come out and get them out and about and have a look around, see what goes on farms. Not too many of them would have been onto a farm or seen shearing for that fact.
I asked a few of them if they've ever seen any sheep being shorn before, and they said no, and they're actually interested in chasing it as a career later on. So
yeah, well, that'll be good. We need all the shearers we can get.
Hey Bobby, you're a police officer, but you're also a fencer and you're a sheep shearer. You're a man of many talents, Mr. Pepper.
Yeah, mate, a man of many talents. I've been doing it for a fair while, so I thought I'd be good at it now. But mate, look, it's always something to learn new in fencing, something new to learn in shearing. And mate, I love my
police job and the people I work with, and just love what I'm doing. Yeah.
Well, we can tell. You can tell. And you got a good rapport with the kids, so keep up the good work.
Thanks, Chris, very much. Yeah.
That was Bobby Pepper finishing off there, chatting to the ABC's Chris Lewis. And if you'd like to see a little snapshot of those kids just loving their time in the wool shed at Andrew's Farm, you can head over to our WA Country Hour Facebook page and check out a nice little video of their visit there.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, we go to the United States for the latest on the investigation into the shooting in Las Vegas. A trauma surgeon who was himself shot releases research that puts the annual cost of gun-related injuries in the US at $3.5 billion.
And in our study, we found that this financial kind of burden doesn't even include, you know, the cost to society, you know, decreased quality of life. And when you look at some of that data, that annual cost is $174 billion.
And the Australian Navy buys a new weapon system. Why do we need one that can shoot down long-range missiles?
More than the headlines. The World Today.
And before we check in with the Mouche sheep sale today, we're going to touch on yesterday's cattle sale at Mouche, because prices may have hit their peak for the season. Numbers were up slightly yesterday, and prices for good quality cattle were also up. Michelle Stanley spoke with Elders Livestock Manager Tom Marin, who says if you're going to sell, now is probably the time.
I just think if you've got them and they're in good condition, or you need to lighten off, yeah, look, any time is the time to do it. I just cannot see anything getting dearer in the near future, of any predominantly dearer anyway. So, yeah, I would think it's a good time.
We have just had a bit of rain about those parts, the sort of southern Gascoyne around the Murchison area. Were they good-looking cattle?
Look, the ones that did sell, and I mean from Meekatharra, we had a consignment of some cows that made, I think, about 170-odd cents a kilo, 174 cents a kilo over a line of, it would have been maybe 30, 40, 50 Brahman-type cross cows in that. So, you know, those cows in those good conditions are making sort of $800 to $900. I know it's a long way down from the earlier part of the year. So they were making sort of $1.70, $1.80 at the most. But, you know, previously, I think in the earlier parts of the year, they were making over the $2 mark.
It is a hard sell when you think about how high those prices did get. But at the same time, I mean, we're still not quite at the lowest of the lows, are we?
No, I know. You're right. And you know, those heavy bulls, those scrub bulls and cull bulls, if they're around 600 kilos, you're most probably getting $1,000 a head. So, to me, that's still pretty good. And steers, there were some good lines of steers there today making $270, $2.80. These are pastoral steers. And that's getting up close to about $900 to $1,000 a head as well.
Tom Marin is the Livestock Sales Manager for Elders WA. And he was speaking there with Michelle Stanley. And in more cattle news today, another live export ship is due to hit Port Hedland in just a couple of weeks. It's going to be the second livestock vessel that the port has seen this year after a drought of about 4 years. The Bison Express will have about 2,800 head of cattle, all sourced from the Pilbara, when it leaves Port Hedland on Saturday, the 14th of October. And we will have some more information for you on that story coming up later in the week. And there were about 11,000 sheep sold at Mouche last week. Numbers were down a little on the previous week. Tracy Kilner is there for us today. Tracy, how did today's sale go?
Hi, Bridget. Our numbers were down for a total yarding of 7,163. The yarding was again dominated by ewes, selling to a top of $105 a head to restockers for merino ewes with a 3-inch fleece, and a pen of heavy new season lambs topped the market at $145 a head. The lightweight lambs sold for $68 to $82 a head. Lambs suitable for air freight made from $85 to $118. Trade weight lambs sold for $118 to $134 a head. And heavy lambs made $137 to $145 a head. Whether lambs to live export sold for $80 to $98, feeder buyers paid $62 to $78 for the store lambs. Hoggets sold for $51 to $126 a head for the heavyweights. The young black tag ewes remained firm this week, selling for $49 for the light ewes and up to $99 a head for the heavyweight Dorper ewes. Mutton gained this week, with medium and trade ewes making $70 to $88 a head. Heavy mutton sold for $70 to $102 a head with a 1-inch fleece, and the store ewes sold for $38 for the lightweights and up to $105 for a pen with a full fleece. Weathers to processors made $80 to $124 a head. Restocker and feeder buyers paid $63 to $117 a head carrying a 3-inch fleece. And live export weathers sold for $78 to $122 a head. Ram lambs to live export sold for $70 to $97 a head. And processors and feeder buyers paid $55 to $95 a head. Slaughter rams sold for $28 to $74, and a couple of merino rams in full fleece sold for $93 to a restocker. Rams to live export made from $55 to $70 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Tracy. And sheep are now worth so much that some police in WA's Great Southern region are getting trained to identify stolen livestock. They were recently trained in Katanning so that they're better able to identify earmarks, tags and correct travel documents. Dumbleyung Police Sergeant Albie Vandenberg told Kit Mocken they're trying to hop on the front foot this year.
At about this time last year, we had a couple of reports of small mobs of sheep between 20 and 50 head. Having been stolen from local properties. And this was followed up in February with a couple of more thefts from properties in the Dumbleyung area. So in response to this, staff here at Dumbleyung, we've done some training with the Department of Agriculture and Food and some officers from our regional West Australian Commissioner's offices. And we're going forward and looking out for the unlawful movement of stock and hopefully find ourselves some sheep stealers.
Sheep prices are really high at the moment. Are you having any reports recently of stock loss?
We haven't had any reports recently, but certainly getting on the front foot because there's certainly a few crops around the area that are looking a bit iffy, and if there are some unscrupulous farmers around that look at supplementing their income with some stolen livestock, with the current price of sheep, there's a fairly good likelihood that we'll get repeat incidents.
So when you're saying that you are going to be monitoring it, does that mean police out at night? What's the process like?
Oh, look, it works on a couple of different levels. Certainly when we see livestock being transported, the likelihood is we'll stop the vehicles and check the sheep, make sure the waybills are intact.
That's Sergeant Albie Vandenberg with Kit Mocken. Just something to be on the lookout for and aware of. Time to get to the news now. It's 1 o'clock.